Only a Game is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org. Additional support comes from the Jackson Laboratory, researching the root causes of cancer and other genetic diseases, designated a cancer center by the National Cancer Institute, JAX.org.
From WBUR in Boston, I'm Bill Littlefield, and this is NPR's Only a Game. The judge threw a curve and the prosecution whiffed before it ever had a chance to bring the heat. Ahead on Only a Game, Roger Clemens walks. Also a look ahead to tomorrow's Women's World Cup final featuring the U.S. and Japan, and a beachy kind of a story involving sand, water, and competitive sculptors. Also ahead, two journalists slash novelists explore the character of Tiger Woods, Tree Tremont.
Maybe Tiger could learn a few things from Tree. We all would like to see a little more of Tiger's humanity. If he could be a little more authentic, I think sports fans would certainly respond to that and would appreciate it.
Stay tuned.
Major funding for Only a Game comes from Oliver Wyman, an international strategy consulting firm. With 3,000 professionals worldwide, Oliver Wyman serves global 1,000 companies. OliverWyman.com.
This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. The perjury trial of Roger Clemens was expected to last a minimum of several weeks. Instead, it ended on Thursday, practically before the jury could get comfortable, when Judge Reggie B. Walton declared a mistrial. The decision was based on the prosecution's introduction of material the judge had ruled inadmissible because it was potentially prejudicial. Of Roger Clemens, Judge Walton said he's entitled to a fair trial. He now cannot get it. Joining me now is Shira Springer of the Boston Globe, who was in the courtroom on Thursday when the mistrial was declared. Shira, welcome back to Only a Game.
Thanks for having me.
The prosecution showed the jury several video clips of Roger Clemens testifying before the House Committee on Oversight and Government Reform. What was on those video clips that violated Judge Walton's guidelines regarding admissibility?
A reference to testimony given by Andy Pettit's wife, Laura Pettit, that basically supported the version of events that Andy Pettit put forth about a conversation he allegedly had with Roger Clemens in which Roger Clemens admitted steroid usage.
And the judge had previously said you can't use that testimony from Mrs. Pettit.
Correct. The judge had previously ruled you can't use that testimony or reference that testimony because Laura Pettit did not speak directly to Roger Clemens.
Judge Walton said, I think a first-year law student should know that you can't bolster the credibility of one witness with clearly inadmissible evidence. Did it seem to you that the judge's intention was to humiliate the prosecutors? Because it sure sounded that way.
Yes. I mean, that was just one of many what I would call harsh scoldings by the judge as he went through his mistrial announcement and told the jury what had happened. He repeatedly chastised the prosecution for the way it behaved. The poor prosecutor, Steve Durham, kept saying, you know, we did not mean to run afoul of the court. This was not done in bad faith, but the judge just wouldn't hear it. He was as animated and as angry as I had heard him throughout the whole proceedings.
Describe the scene in the courtroom for us as the judge declared the mistrial.
Rusty Hardin, the lead defense attorney, makes the motion for mistrial. You can see that the judge really doesn't want to declare it, given all the time it took to seat the jury, 4 days to seat the jury. He says, you know, listen, I'm going to take a break and consult with a colleague. He comes back 45 minutes later, and you can see just by the look on his face, he sort of had this crestfallen look, and he was shaking his head when he got up to the bench. And I think we all kind of anticipated it, but still, it was pretty shocking. You know, everybody had been revved up for this trial, this 4 to 6 week trial. You know, this process had just gone on and on and on and been a very slow grind toward finally getting to the point where there were opening statements on Wednesday, and then, you know, testimony and witnesses was finally beginning to be revealed on Thursday. And it was sort of like, you know, deflating of a balloon. It was like, a gasp and then a sigh, like, oh, my gosh.
Once the judge had made the decision that this would end in a mistrial, what did Clemens do and how did he take it?
Clemens remained almost as expressionless as he has throughout the proceedings. The time that I saw him, he was unsmiling. He declined comment because there was a, or still is, a gag order. But it was quite interesting. He exited the courtroom, shook hands with some security guards, hugged some court officials, and then began to walk away from the courtroom, surrounded by a group of about 35 media members there. And this gaggle, for lack of a better word, walked, as I did, with him about two blocks to a nearby Au Bon Pain, surrounding him. And he was going into the restaurant for lunch, and we were shouting questions at him about how he felt, and he just sort of stared straight ahead, and, you know, occasionally Rusty Hardin would put his arm around him, but it was a very bizarre scene. We were sort of like this moving traffic jam of people surrounding Roger Clemens.
Some had questioned whether Clemens' attorneys were up to the task of defending him. At least they knew when to ask for a mistrial. Have Rusty Hardin at all acquitted themselves well?
Before going into this, having not seen Rusty Hardin in the courtroom, I had the same general perception that's out there that, like you said, maybe this guy wasn't quite up to the task. But watching him in action, he has this style that's very personable, very engaging, and in fact, very effective. It was in full evidence when he was selecting the jury. He's just this sort of southern, nice to meet you, hail fellow, well met kind of guy, and it comes across very engaging, and he certainly had the attention and I think had engendered some warm feeling from the jury. Opening statement was a little bit rambling throughout the whole hour, but he made a few strong points, and he certainly had the more memorable opening statement.
Judge Walton called for a hearing on September 2nd to determine whether there will be a new trial. Why should it take a month and a half for the prosecution to decide whether to regroup and try again?
I think they're going to. I think it's more a legal question. I guess the wheels of justice turn slowly, or however the phrase goes, and there's motions to be filed and paperwork. So various legal steps have to be taken along the way. I also think it's a question of the court calendar. I mean, this, as I said before, has been just a slow grind all along. I mean, it's been 3 years, more than 3 years, since the government started preparing its case. And from what was said from the prosecution, they had prepared for about 45 witnesses. There were around 300 exhibits. I mean, this was a massive, massive effort by the government, and I think they're in too deep to give up now.
Roger Clemens has said from the start that he wants to clear his name. Do you think a decision not to proceed with another trial would leave Clemens feeling vindicated?
No, and that's sort of the irony of this all. The correct opinion, and the opinion that many people have voiced about this, is that this is a big win. This mistrial is a big win for Roger Clemens. And even though he would be facing possible prison time in another trial, I think there might be, as crazy as this sounds, a part of him that wants to have his day in court. And, you know, as Rusty Hardin said in his opening, Roger Clemens has been waiting for an opportunity to tell his side of the story.
Shira Springer writes for the Boston Globe, and she was in the Washington, D.C. courtroom where the trial of Roger Clemens ended in a mistrial on Thursday. Shira, thanks very much for speaking with me.
You're very welcome.
At noon on Wednesday, as the U.S. women's soccer team began playing France in the game that would propel one of the two teams into the finals of the World Cup in Germany, numbers of fans in the Boston area were gathering in sports bars to watch the action over a long lunch. At the Coolidge Corner Clubhouse in Brookline, one fellow surrounded by TV sets tuned to the game seemed more interested in his iPhone.
I'm actually relaying scores to somebody who's traveling. Women are playing very well for the U.S. They look better than most MLS teams, to be honest with you.
The U.S. scored first in that game and carried a 1-0 lead into the second half. Perhaps a mile away at the Sunset Cantina, I idly asked a fan named Keith if he thought that one goal would be enough.
I don't know. It's tough. France is really moving the ball well, so I'd like to see a little bit of insurance.
So now we know one goal isn't going to be enough.
Apparently not. We'll have to get another one.
Another one would come, as would one more. The 3-1 victory over France, coupled with Japan's triumph over Sweden in the later semifinal, meant that the U.S. would avoid the team that had beaten them during the group stage. But according to Sports Illustrated's Grant Wall, who has been covering the tournament in Germany, the U.S. will underestimate Japan at their peril.
They really have a good vision for the game, and they kind of make up for the fact that they're not tall and strong and really that fast. And so there's a real contrast in styles when they play a team like the U.S., which is known for its athleticism and size and toughness. And it's been working well for Japan, but you still have to remember here that Japan has never beaten the United States in 25 games and has lost to them 3 times this year.
Commentators have been telling those of us watching the World Cup on TV in the U.S. that Abby Wambach, Hope Solo, Megan Rapinoe et al. Won the hearts of fans in Germany with their tenacious quarterfinal win over Brazil. But according to Grant Wall, the Japanese team has also built a fan base in Germany and beyond.
Every game in this tournament, the Japanese players have carried a sign around in English thanking everyone for their support of Japan after the tsunami and earthquake. I think that's really struck a chord with the fans here in Germany, with the people watching around the world. And the audience on television globally has been very impressive, including in Japan. We're talking 3-4 million people watching, which is much bigger than that team has ever had before.
This development has not escaped the attention of U.S. players who've been wired into reaction to the tournament via email, texts, tweets, and Facebook. They know lots of fans were rooting for the U.S. after one of the Brazilians, Erica, faked a serious injury during the quarterfinal to delay that game. But in a conference call on Thursday, U.S. goalkeeper Hope Solo acknowledged the popularity of the Japanese team.
And Japan, yes, they are the sentimental favorites of this tournament. They're playing for something bigger and better than the game. And when you're playing with so much emotion and so much heart, that's hard to play against. So I think it's going to be an incredible final that people didn't expect to see.
It has been suggested that a U.S. win would boost interest in the Women's Pro Soccer League in this country, the 6 teams of which employ many of the world's best players. Certainly the close games and upsets over the past couple of weeks in Germany have demonstrated the number of solid women's teams has grown. But Grant Wall cautions against making the same mistake some people made in 1999 when they assumed that women's soccer would draw big crowds from that heady moment on.
I've learned covering soccer over the years never to think there's going to be some magic bullet that makes soccer a huge thing day-to-day in the U.S. the way it is in the rest of the world. And so I think we should take this World Cup that the U.S. is doing so well in as a nice event that is very inspirational and not try and make any crazy predictions about what it means for the sport in America, except to say that it should, you would think, help a little bit with WPS.
The final, matching Japan, newcomers to the spotlight, with the U.S., 2-time World Cup champions, happens tomorrow in Frankfurt. It's 19 minutes past the hour. At the age of 6, Reagan Kennedy had already absorbed enough golf etiquette from her father to know that players are supposed to be quiet on the course. But had Dad taught young Reagan too well? When she aced the par-3 third hole at the links in Ireland Grove, Illinois last week, Reagan's older sister had to tell her that it was okay to shout when you got a hole in one. "We told her that's the one time you can scream," said 13-year-old Cheyenne. Reagan began swinging a club when she was 2 and played in her first tournament last month. She says her ultimate goal is to beat her father, ungrateful whelp.
You're everything nice, and your daddy is little girl.
I'm Bill Littlefield, coming up on Only a Game, a book-length, allegedly fictional version of Tiger Woods. But first, lots of cities, counties, towns, and states have ended up regretting the deals they've made with pro sports franchises. But perhaps Hamilton County, Ohio, leads the league in that sorry category. The construction agreements county officials made 15 years ago with the Cincinnati Bengals and the Cincinnati Reds have been characterized as some of, quote, the worst professional sports deals ever struck by a local government. Reed Albergati and Cameron McWhirter of the Wall Street Journal wrote that line, and Reed Albergati joins me now from the newsroom of the Wall Street Journal. Welcome to Only a Game.
Thanks for having me. It's always good to be on.
Your article suggests one problem is that no two parties involved can agree on how much building Paul Brown Stadium for the Bengals actually cost, somewhere between $350 million and $555 million. Why the discrepancy?
These deals are so confusing. It's true that the one thing, and this is one area where the deal, you know, in Hamilton County is not unique. They are all so complicated and have so many different cost structures, and there's infrastructure included in building the stadium. There's parking. There's all kinds of hidden costs, and they often end up costing a lot more than they originally thought they would cost. So there's a lot of different ways of looking at it. So we tried to give kind of the spectrum, the lower estimates up to the $555 million estimate of the Harvard professor that we quoted in the story.
You write of, quote, unforeseen consequences for Hamilton County. What was the nature of the unpleasant surprise, and what are those consequences likely to be in 2011 and beyond?
Hamilton County thought that they could cover the cost of the debt service for the stadiums with a 0.5% sales tax. And they based that projection, their financial projections, on about 3% sales tax growth every year on into, you know, the 30 years or so that they have to pay off these bonds. So that didn't happen. In 2000, sales taxes started going down. 9/11 happened. You know, then we had the financial collapse, and instead of new tax revenue going into other parts of the budget and closing budget gaps, they have to earmark these taxes, you know, potentially, they haven't done it yet, but potentially toward paying off these stadiums, which, you know, is causing all sorts of budget havoc in Hamilton County.
Mark Reed, the administrator of Hamilton County's juvenile court, told you that the stadium deals were, quote, the monster that ate the public sector. Did that strike you as an exaggeration?
It's a great quote. And what he means by that is that all the things on the budget for Hamilton County can be moved and cut. And that's what they've done. You know, they've cut the sheriff's department and they cut Mark Reed's department, you know, the juvenile courts. Well, the stadium can't be cut. I mean, that is an immovable object that they have to pay for. And so by obligating themselves to pay for that, everyone else has to take sort of bigger and longer lasting cuts. I mean, on top of that, the unemployment rate is very high. The poverty rate's high in the region. And to be fair to the, you know, the county and the teams involved, they'd be having a hard time either way. Mm. It's just one thing that exacerbates the problem.
Why did Hamilton County take on these projects by themselves? Why wasn't the state of Ohio involved? Why wasn't the debt spread over a larger area?
Originally, this was a city council issue, which is a much bigger body of government. And what happened was the county, Hamilton County, they have three people on their board of commissioners, said, you know what, we'll take this thing over. And so it went from the large city council to a three-person commission deciding on what to do and how to fund the stadium.
Did those folks think it was a good deal when they made it? Did they think they were going to make money eventually, bring in jobs, all that stuff that usually people talk about when they keep teams in places?
The person who spearheaded it for Hamilton County was a guy named Bob Bettinghouse, and he now works for the Bengals. He was voted out of office.
That's pretty funny.
And he very politely declined to speak with me for the article. But from what I could gather from other people I spoke with who were involved at the time, they thought that this was a pretty standard deal in terms of the lease negotiations. But what it really was probably about the best possible deal. You know, it was kind of an all-star of deals. And the cost, after all the cost overruns, became definitely the most expensive NFL stadium ever built. Later, years later, the Indianapolis Colts got one that got more public money, but that bill was footed by, you know, six different counties and the state paying for it. It wasn't just one county.
Do either of the teams involved, the Bengals or the Reds, take any responsibility for the loss of services?
No. In fact, yeah, the Bengals have made that very clear. They really feel that this is all on the county. And, you know, they also make the point that the county did use some of the sales tax money to pay for things other than stadiums. They put some money into public schools, into roads. They put about $1 million a year of that sales tax money into developing the riverfront around the stadium, which never really got off the ground as people hoped it would after the stadiums were built. So they do have a point there, but, you know, that spending is pretty low compared to the cost of the stadiums.
Reed Albergati and Cameron McWhirter wrote, "A Stadium's Costly Legacy Throws Taxpayers for a Loss," which appeared in the Wall Street Journal. And Reed Albergati joined me from the newsroom of the Wall Street Journal. Reed, thanks very much for speaking with me.
Thanks for having me.
One thing was clear entering today's round of the British Open. Nobody seemed to be duplicating Rory McIlroy's run through the U.S. Open, during which he left the field in his wake. Lucas Glover and Darren Clark were tied at the top of the leaderboard at 4 under par. 4 players trailed them by just a stroke, and 7 more hopefuls were lurking just 2 shots off the pace. The aforementioned Mr. McIlroy shot 69 yesterday and stood at even par, just 4 shots behind the leaders. 5-time champion Tom Watson, who is 61, provided one of yesterday's highlights when he sunk his tee shot on the par 3 16th hole, his first hole-in-one in 115 rounds of play at the Open. The protagonist in The Swinger, a new novel set in golf, is nicknamed Tree. Tree has moved from child golf prodigy to Masters champion in record time, signed lots of endorsement contracts, become a multi-millionaire, married a beautiful woman, fathered 2 lovely children, and if you don't recognize the real-world model for Tree yet, you really haven't been paying attention. The Swinger was written by 2 senior writers at Sports Illustrated, Alan Shipnuck, who joins me from KAZU in Monterey, California. Alan, welcome back to the program.
Thank you very much.
And Michael Bamberger, who joins us now on the line. Michael, welcome back to you as well.
Thank you, Bill.
I've mentioned already some of the similarities between Tiger Woods and Tree Tremont. There are others. Both are sons of fathers who made careers in the military and served in Vietnam, and who claimed their sons would have a greater influence on the world than did Jesus. Michael, is there any significant way in which Tree differs from Tiger?
Yes, Tree is obsessed with using good grammar, even though he struggles with it, because his mother was a Caucasian English teacher from Chicago who was very dedicated to using language properly.
Okay. The narrator in The Swinger is a newspaper man until he leaves the paper to work full-time for Tree Tremont Enterprises. Part of his job is to convince other newspaper men that Tree Tremont's private life is none of their business. Michael, do you agree with that contention?
Yes, I really don't care about the private lives of the athletes that we cover. I think it's an absolute joke that we are going to hold them up to some high standard of what somebody else says is ethical behavior. And whatever happens between Tree Tremont and his wife, Belinda, you can fill in any names you like there, is their business, and they should work it out on their time. And people say, oh, he took all this money from Buick and blah, blah, blah. I really couldn't care. He got that money because he was, you know, as my colleague Alan Shipka says, the greatest closer in the history of sport. That's why he made that money, not because he was some paragon of the family man. He's not our preacher. He's not an elected official. He's not a school teacher. He's just an athlete.
At one point, the narrator, Josh Dutra, says, and I'm quoting now, "Hanging out with Tree Tremont was as intoxicating as anything I'd ever done." Alan, is that the way writers following Tiger Woods felt about being in his presence?
To some degree. You know, Tiger was such a transcendent athlete and such a charismatic figure, but
most riders didn't get to hang out with Tiger. We were sort of denied that, and we never got to know him. And just the extent of that was made clear when the scandal broke and everyone was kind of scratching their heads saying, wow, did you know about that? Well, maybe a little, not really.
But that's the interesting thing to me. Well, maybe, I don't know, a little. Writers were close enough to him to know that something was going on, no?
I'll tell you what a bad reporter I am. I had no idea at all.
Well, I'd heard a few whispers, but, you know, the PGA Tour is like high school with money. It's a very cloistered little world, and it's full of rumor mongering and backstabbing and cliques. And the fact that you hear a little something doesn't mean it's true. So, no, certainly no one knew the extent and the scope of it. And that just drove home the fact that we never really knew Tiger Woods.
I don't feel like I know Tiger Woods at all. I've covered the guy for, you know, since he was an amateur teenager in California. He's unknowable. To be that public and to give that many press conferences and to reveal that little about yourself takes a certain level of genius. When he was still, I think, in high school, he was hanging out with a writer named Jaime Diaz, who writes for Golf Digest, and he said to Jaime at one point, why do they have to know everything? And, of course, he was talking about the press. That struck me as one of the truest things you've ever heard come out of Tiger Woods' mouth, and I think it informed everything he's done in public since then.
Alan, are you at all concerned about how Tiger Woods himself will respond to this novel? I mean, assuming he returns to the tour and plays well, how much access do you guys expect to get?
Well, we've already gotten a nice flame mail from his publicist, so we know at least the people around him are not thrilled about the book. But, of course, when that was written, they hadn't read it yet, and we've put copies in the hands of people close to Tiger. We'd love for Tiger to read the book. He's an ideal reader. He'll get all the jokes. He'll understand the historical allusions. You know, he's a sophisticated golf fan, so I think if he actually read it, not only would he appreciate those aspects of it, but we treat our protagonist, Tree, with a certain empathy and understanding that I don't think Tiger's been afforded in the real world. So hopefully Tiger will read the book, and that will soften his feelings toward it. As far as being worried about future access, you know, before the book, we had almost no access. and not just personally, but reporters in general. So that's been a constant theme. Oh, Tiger's never going to talk to you again. Well, he never really talked to us in the first place, so we're not really risking very much. But I really do hope he reads a book. And, you know, the shrillest criticism of this story is going to come from those who don't read it. I think people who pick it up will really have they'll change their feelings towards what Tiger's been through based on, you know, what we put our protagonist through.
Well, tell me a little bit more about the response from Tiger's camp before they had the opportunity to read the book.
Well, it was just basic garden variety, belly aching. You know, how could you do this? This story is not about Tiger Woods, but no question his travails helped inspire us and to create this, you know, alternate universe where we could really get to know the characters. So, again, I think that if Tiger reads a book, we'd love to have an informed discussion with him about it. If he never picks it up, it's going to be hard to penetrate the ill feelings of those around him.
And if I could just follow on that, I think Alan said something really important. This book is written with a lot of, as Alan just said, sympathy and empathy for our protagonist. The more writing we did, we found we liked the guy more and more, and we felt sorry for him more and more. And the real life Tiger Woods is almost like a freak show, the way he grew up. You know, here's this kid at age 3 on the Mike Douglas show, and everybody's looking at him all the time and never really had the opportunity to be socialized in, you know, certainly in a conventional way. Often talks about the 2 years at Stanford that he had as the best 2 years of his life when he could actually hang out with other kids and be a little bit of a kid. But, I mean, Tiger Woods has not had a normal life. Tremendous wealth and tremendous opportunity, tremendous temptation, as we know now. And he made the decisions that he made. And I know there are people who hear what I just said, and they'll think it's a joke. But I don't think it's a joke. I don't think Alan does either. You know, we felt our new jobs as novelists was to try, and what we do when we write nonfiction too, is try to get to understand the character.
I'm speaking with Alan Shipnuck and Michael Bamberger, authors of The Swinger, and you're listening to Only a Game. The similarities between Tiger Woods and Tree Tremont are so numerous that some readers are bound to think that you guys are revealing new information about Woods. You put a specific number on the number of women with whom he cheated on his wife, for example. Would those readers be wrong?
They really would be, and they really shouldn't do that. This is absolutely a novel. There are a lot of broad similarities. not for a minute be confused for the real-life Tiger Woods.
I don't want to give away any more of the plot of the novel than we perhaps already have, although much of it will be apparent to anybody who has followed the story of Tiger Woods. But, Alan, were you trying to suggest to Mr. Woods an ending that his story might have?
I don't think that we're that presumptuous, but, you know, what's appealing about what happens with Tree is he learns from his mistakes, and he comes to the public and he admits them, and he had a double life, he had a triple life, and certainly there's some parallels to what Tiger's been through. And, you know, he talked about when he came back from his scandal, he was going to do things differently and he was going to be more open, and that really hasn't happened. If anything, he's become more cloistered, and we all would like to see a little more of Tiger's humanity. He can be an extremely funny person in private. If he could be a little more authentic, I think sports fans would certainly respond to that and would appreciate it.
I mean, look where Kobe Bryant is now. You know, look where Bill Clinton is now. I mean, to think of someone who's actually important. You know, Mike Tyson's in The Hangover, you know, a convicted rapist. It's part of our generous spirit as Americans is the second chance. My own feeling, I think Alan probably feels the same. There's absolutely no reason why Tiger Woods, with all his talent and all his wealth and all his fame, can't do tremendous good works, which he already is doing philanthropically, and lead a great, happy, productive life. Why not?
Alan Shipnuck and Michael Bamberger, both Sports Illustrated senior writers, have written The Swinger, a novel published by Simon & Schuster. Alan Shipnuck joined me from KAZU in Monterey, California. Alan, thanks very much.
Thank you, Bill.
And Michael Bamberger spoke to us from his home. Michael, thanks to you as well.
Thanks for having us.
What are you if not some kind of swinger? A madam from the cold who's so hot. You are the one I should ruin my life for. So I've always been taught. What is he, some kind of swinger? The kind who sells you shampoo. What is he, some kind of swinger?
It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced, Harvard University, whose Harvard Extension School has online and on-campus courses for students around the world, extension.harvard.edu, and Oliver Wyman, an international strategy consulting firm. With 3,000 professionals worldwide, Oliver Wyman serves global 1,000 companies. OliverWyman.com. This is NPR.
Tatanka.
More than 100 people competed in the dried buffalo dung throw at last weekend's Fur Trade Days celebration in Chadron, Nebraska. The youngest competitor was 4 years old, and he didn't even come close to winning. That distinction went to Jason Orr, a 28-year-old man who tossed his buffalo chip almost 168 feet. Hopeful tossers from six states had gathered for the opportunity to compete in one of seven divisions, meaning that somebody actually put some time into organizing this weird enterprise. Winners got plaques featuring a buffalo chip that had been spray-painted gold, silver, or bronze. I'm going to stop now.
I've got the spirit of the buffalo, spirit of the buffalo, spirit of the buffalo.
I'm Bill Littlefield, coming up on Only a Game with a nod to Pat Boone. On a day like today, we pass the time away building castles, statues, and various other extraordinary edifices in the sand, or at least some of us do. But first, I'm joined by Charlie Pierce for our look at the week's news. Hello, Charlie.
Oh, I'm sorry. Is it my turn now? Because that was the longest intro in Only a Game history.
Yes, and very few people will know what I'm talking about, but there it is.
He shotgun with the wind in the last time.
Tomorrow, the U.S. will face Japan in the final of the Women's World Cup. So you were right, after all, when you picked a winner. At least you still might be.
I could be. I still think that the U.S. gals will win. The height differential, which doesn't often come up in soccer when you think about it, is pretty overwhelming. Plus, I think that if you really want to argue the destiny question, then you've really got to argue it in favor of the United States after the Brazil game.
The quarterfinal game, in which the U.S. caught Brazil with almost no time left and then won via penalty kicks, drew the highest rating of any Women's World Cup game since that summer of 99 when the U.S. won it all. I wonder if that record is going to fall tomorrow.
It's entirely possible. I mean, it's a great week for this to be happening because there's virtually nothing else going on. I'd like to see the actual ratings chart on that to see how many of the people who watched it did what I did, which was to hear on the radio that the United States was losing, but that it was a really good game and the United States was getting cheated, and then turn the game. And I swear, this is what I did. And I'll bet that 90% of that ratings number is from the middle of the second half on.
Those who've been waiting for a resolution in the matter of U.S. v. Roger Clemens, alleged perjurer, will have to wait until September to learn if the process of trying Mr. Clemens will proceed. The judge declared a mistrial on Thursday. That didn't take long, did it?
No. Stop. Nothing. It's over. No more of my money going into this stupid drug frenzy, leaving aside the fact that the government, in this case, the federal prosecutors, couldn't have blown this case any worse if they were trying. I mean, how many trials do you know in which the prosecution doesn't get five sentences before the judge declares a mistrial and sends everybody home?
Major League Baseball's All-Star Game played on Tuesday night is not the attraction that it once was. That game drew a record low rating. Is Major League Baseball doing something wrong in terms of marketing?
I don't know. We had an entire week of the drumbeat in the national press saying that the baseball All-Star Game isn't what it used to be. So why would we be surprised that people just said, okay, it's not what it used to be, I'm not turning in. 8:30 on a Tuesday night is a tough call.
Spectators at this week's British Open were treated to early holes-in-one by Tom Watson and Dustin Johnson. What is in the water in Sandwich, England?
I don't know, but it's a great story. I mean, Tom Watson goes to the British Open every couple of years and does something remarkable. I'm very happy for him.
This week, Patriots quarterback Tom Brady said, and I'm quoting, "It's time to wrap up the negotiations and end the lockout." So, what's everybody waiting for,
well,
right? Tom Brady said that.
Apparently, the owners have called an audible saying, "Wait here, Jose. We haven't gotten everything we want yet."
James Harrison of the Pittsburgh Steelers employed another strategy for ending the NFL lockout. Tell us about that.
Apparently, the way to end the NFL lockout is to go in a magazine and rip Roger Goodell, the commissioner of the NFL, up one side and down the other, including telling him that if he was on fire, James Harrison would consider all his options and not do anything, if you know what I mean, and I think you do.
I think I do.
I expect that once things get back to normal in the NFL, he'll be hearing from the fine police again.
The NBA lockout remains in effect. Players received a windfall this week. How'd that happen in the middle of a lockout?
They got some escrow money returned to them because the salaries were below 57% of league revenues last year. This is a report from SI.com, quoting sources familiar with the situation. If that's the case, then this whole notion of how salaries are just breaking these poor, beleaguered, apple-selling NBA owners took another hit.
Apple selling, very nice in that context. Billy Hunter, the head of the NBA Players Union, said this week that the association supports players looking to play overseas while the lockout is in effect. Can those determined to look for silver lining this cloud assume that basketball teams in Turkey, Italy, Spain, etc. are going to suddenly improve?
Well, yeah, but it all depends on whether the teams overseas will give the players opt-out options in their contracts so they can come back and play whenever the NBA starts playing again. The Turkish team that signed that is negotiating with the New Jersey Nets, Deron Williams, their point guard, has already said they'll probably do that. And I would suspect that while the mainland European teams in places like Italy and Spain and France are holding out against this, as the season gets closer with the possibility of filling their buildings beyond their wildest dreams, that the opt-out clause will happen there too.
Meanwhile, Georgia Tech is the most recent university to feel the disciplinary hand of the NCAA on its shoulder-padded shoulder, and actually on the unpadded shoulder of its basketball team as well. What's been amiss there?
Apparently, there's been some dealings with agents down in Atlanta. It's been a tough month for Atlanta.
Shocked
to learn this. Once again, the NCAA can go back to the buffet table and claim that it's done something substantial. All it's done is sort of annoy a bunch of players.
It's a weird time of year to talk hockey, but I can't help it because I have here a picture of the goalie helmet that Steve Mason of the Columbus Blue Jackets will be wearing next season. I'm not sure we can do justice to the imagery on this helmet just by talking about it on the radio, but you want to try?
First of all, it has nothing to do with Columbus or the Blue Jackets.
No.
Hopefully this will be up on our Only a Game website because this is really priceless. It's modeled on the Evil Dead. Actually, it's modeled for Evil Dead 2. It's got a Civil War soldier.
Blue Jackets.
But it looks like a Confederate soldier. with what appears to be a gun, and there's lots of skulls and a grim reaper and a crow. And just,
I was looking at this earlier. I'm telling you, if I'm coming in on a breakaway on
I'm
this
shooting
guy,
fast.
I shear off and miss the net.
Oh, no, I'm aiming right at his head. I'm killing the zombies. I'm just glad it's that this guy plays for a team nobody cares about, because otherwise the NHL would be really upset.
And finally, Charlie, we have a story from China.
Sports!
About a guy whose girlfriend jokingly told him that she would marry him if he would walk 1,000 miles. So do you suppose Ms. Ling Hui is regretting that playful challenge?
Well, actually, she's a fan of the band The Proclaimers, the old Scottish duo.
I remember the song.
Did a song. Her boyfriend has said, all right, fine, I'll walk 1,000 miles. And the fiancé told, and I'm assuming this is a rough translation, told the local media, he's such a fruitcake. I would have married him anyway, and I was only joking when I said he had to walk 1,000 miles. You know what? If the guy had get away from Scottish pop and just listened to Old Time Soul, if he just listened to Edwin Starr, he would have only had to walk 25 miles.
Charlie Pierce is the author of Idiot America, a connoisseur of music, popular and not so much. He joins me each week at this time on Only a Game as well. Thank you, Charlie.
Thanks, Tom.
In 1896, America's first public beach was established in Revere, a working-class city 5 miles north of Boston. 100 years later, the city and the beach had seen better days, and both were the recipients of a multi-million-dollar revitalization effort. In 2004, the beach was designated as a National Historic Landmark, and every year since has welcomed entrants from around the globe to the Revere Beach National Sand Sculpting Festival. Only a Game's Karen Given has our story.
I made it all the way to China!
The kids playing in the surf at Revere Beach on this sunny Wednesday afternoon seem more concerned with digging a hole to China than they are with building sandcastles. But just up the beach behind them, 10 professional sand sculptors from 4 countries and 5 U.S. states are hard at work.
There's no tricks, no magic. It's sand and water. There's nothing else to it.
Meredith Corson flies up from Treasure Island, Florida every year to organize this event. Meredith herself has been a sand sculptor for more than 25 years, and it's now her full-time job. Believe it or not, sculpting sand is a pretty good living.
In an event like this, the sculptors don't have any expenses. Their hotel, their airfare, their food, everything is sponsored. And every sculptor gets an appearance fee. Whether they win or not, they get an appearance fee.
With a $5,000 prize for first place, this is a competition in every sense of the word. Sculptors must do all the work themselves, no hiring younger backs for the heavy lifting, and they have just 30 hours over 4 days to complete their entries. Corson says competition isn't for everyone.
And you know, there are some incredible sand sculptors in the world, but they're not competitors because maybe they don't want to do the physical part of it. So it's not just being a good sculptor. You have to be physical, you have to be fast, and you have to be talented.
Today is known as Pound Up Day. Each competitor is given an 18 by 18 plot and 12 tons of sand, a special variety trucked in from Hudson, New Hampshire. At the sound of a whistle, they cross over the barrier into their plots and begin shoveling. Those 12 tons of sand had to first be moved to the side, allowing for wooden or plastic forms to be carefully positioned in the center of each plot. Then it's compression time. For the rest of the day, a layer at a time, each sculptor shovels sand into a form, tops it off with bucket after bucket of water, and stomps each layer flat like the characters on I Love Lucy stomped grapes for wine. What's left, Corson says, doesn't look at all like a sand sculpture.
Most of them that are using the wood, if you look at them, it looks like a birthday cake. It looks like tiers of a birthday cake or a wedding cake. And then when they're at the top, it's dual purpose. That's also their scaffolding.
While most of his rivals are still stomping, Jonathan Bouchard, or Joby, from Montreal, Canada, has already removed his forms. His sculpture is beginning to take a familiar shape.
I'm building a turtle, but something is going to happen with this turtle, and I can't really say what. Not because it's a surprise. Well, actually, it's a surprise, but it's even a surprise for me. I don't know yet. Well, it's a work in progress, so we'll see what happens.
Joby won this event last year with his sculpture of a fish. Not just any fish. This fish was hollow. Inside its mouth stood the perfectly formed figure of a man. Think Jonah and the whale. It was something no one had seen before, and because the competitors choose the winner, Joby's innovation was rewarded. He says it's nice to be judged by people who know the difference between something new and cheap tricks intended to wow the crowd.
Normally we're judged from people in the artistic
community.
Yeah, that's it. They don't know about the technique, they don't know about a lot of things particular to sand carving.
Further down the beach, Matthew Martelli groans as he lifts yet another bucket of water over his head and dumps it into his rectangular-shaped forms.
Building up the forms, the hardest part of the job.
Yeah.
The nightmare.
If you haven't guessed from his accent, Martelli is from Revere, but he doesn't have a home sand advantage. While most of his rivals do nothing but make ephemeral art out of sand, snow, and ice, Martelli is a painter who only builds one sand sculpture a year, and the backbreaking labor has worn him out.
Will I be tired? I'll be dead tonight. I gotta refresh myself. That's why a lot of these guys, they start carving right away and everything. I'll be carving tomorrow. If I start carving now, I'll probably screw it up.
Many decades Martelli's junior, Sue McGrew, softly groans as she climbs down her two-tiered wooden form. In a red visor, mirrored sunglasses, and covered head to toe in sand, McGrew looks like she practically lives on the beach. She actually lives in Tacoma, but McGrew didn't exactly come here straight from Washington.
You could say that, because I actually just came from Europe. Latvia, actually. And it's a nice competition, 5-day event. No time limit. It's so relaxed. Kind of the opposite of this, but yeah.
McGrew got her start when she was still in high school, which makes her one of the youngest professional sand sculptors in the world. As a recent college graduate with a degree in stage management from USC, she didn't expect to make it her full-time career.
When I started, it was just such a fun thing. I just loved getting into the sand and getting dirty and making sculptures. But pretty much the economy crashed in 2008. I didn't have a job, so I just started doing more contests and then doing more contests and then doing more sand work, and now it's all I do.
As she shovels another layer of sand over her head, McGrew laughs at her male competitor's obvious height advantage. Maybe as a result, while some choose to build tall, McGrew's forms are wide and lower to the ground. But she's tight-lipped about what will emerge from the sand over the next 4 days.
I'm going to give you the same answer probably everyone else has given you. I'm not sure yet. I'm still thinking about it.
If you're this far on your pound up to where you've moved, 7, 10, 12 tons of sand, you know what you're doing. Because you don't do this and go, okay, what do I want to do now? It just doesn't work that way.
Dan Doubleday has been competitively carving sand for 16 years, and he seems to think his opponents know more than they're letting on. He says it's all just part of the game.
We call it a spart, half sport, half art, because it's a timed event. We're competing for prize money. And yet this part of it, the solo competition, you're going to see some of the finest pieces of art in the world. Probably the best sand sculpting that's ever been done is going to be done here this week.
Really?
Really.
And if I went to another competition, would they tell me the same thing?
No, not a chance. We have talent that we have found around the world. We've been to China, we've been to Australia, we've competed in Europe, all over the place.
Doubleday started building sand sculptures while his kids played on the beaches of California. After a while, he was invited to his first competition, which led to his second, which led to a new career. He helps run this competition with his partner, Meredith Corson, and the pair traveled to competitions, exhibitions, television appearances, and corporate jobs all over the world.
Quite a ride since 96, huh? I never left the States until I started this stuff. I had no clue I would travel the world, and they're paying me to do it. It's so big in China that one event, 300,000 people showed up opening day. I've never seen that many people, and they all treat you like like, you know, you're some sort of rock star over there.
Organizers expect 300,000 people to visit Revere Beach over the entire course of the four-day festival, and nobody's treating anyone like a rock star. But that doesn't mean Doubleday isn't bringing his best work. On Wednesday afternoon, his sculpture is nothing more than a round structure with some inverted cone shapes at the top. But he doesn't even bother to pretend that he doesn't know what it is.
So what are you carving today?
Oh, I am carving, I can't tell you that. I mean, that's the, when you get to this level of sand sculpture, you've seen about everything that can be done in sand. The secrets here are the ideas. You don't let it out.
All will be completed and revealed when Doubleday and his competitors put down their tools this afternoon. The sculptures will remain standing until the elements render them unrecognizable, at which point the city will flatten them into an extra soft layer for beachgoers to enjoy for the rest of the summer. For Only a Game, I'm Karen Given.
And for every child on the beach that day stands a castle tall and proud, and the warm wind crawls through the castle walls, and the night folk wake as the warm wind calls at night.
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Doug Trabu. Our technical director is John Perotti. Our intern is Allison Gluck. We had help this week from Jared Mooney and from Andrew Kramer at KAZU in Monterey. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. To view Karen Given's sand sculpture photo gallery or learn more about this week's music selections, please visit our website, onlyagame.org. Our final word comes from sand sculptor Dan Doubleday, who remembers his early days on the beaches of California.
We didn't have good sand there, but I found sandy beaches that I liked, and girls were cute, you know. I was a single dad, you know.
And we'll stop right there, I think. I'm Bill Littlefield. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next week.
Still, when the south wind blows and the air is warm, there's a world that's born.
Support comes from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. The William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, online at wtgrantfoundation.org. And the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live healthy, productive lives, at gatesfoundation.org. This is NPR.